Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we look at the science fiction field from all angles, past, present, and future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And it's late September 2023, which sounds like a song. But in this episode, we're going to look at our Desert Island books. Or at least I think we are. Is that what you think, Colin?
That's what I think too, yes.
Good. And we also have a quiz from a listener. And we have our usual roundup of past, present, and future science fiction. Before we go into any of that, some feedback from listeners on our Doctor Who discussion. We heard from our French-speaking friend and listener, Emmanuel, who guested on the podcast a number of episodes ago. And he says, "Very good episode, as usual. Doctor Who always struck me as very unusual in the TV world. This series is huge in the UK and seems very well known in the States, but it's almost unknown in the Francophone world. Most Anglo science fiction makes it to the French-speaking world and obtains a very good level of success. But for some reason, Doctor Who never really made it. It is translated and broadcast, but I'd say the average person doesn't know or care about this series. It's funny how something that runs for so long can be a cultural phenomenon on one side of the channel and a dud on the other." How interesting.
Yeah.
Then we heard from Andy, who supplies the quiz that we'll be using later in the show. And Andy said, "Great episode, you've done it again." Did you hear that, Colin? We've done it again. Could be
we
good.
We do it every month.
Yeah. He says, "Doctor Who is something that's always in the background of my watching tastes and never really made it to my to-be-watched list. I've seen countless episodes over the years and always enjoyed them. I guess it's the completest in me. If I was going to watch them, I'd have to watch all of them. So maybe I'll queue them up ready for the next pandemic and get isolated for 10 days. But anyway, enjoyed the podcast on a topic that's on the periphery of taste." I think he means the periphery of his taste. It makes it sound as if our podcast was in bad taste. Anyway, he also says he's planning to go to the 2024 Worldcon. And he says it would be great to say hi in person. He's assuming that you and I are going to go, you see. And then he says,
"Oh, yeah.
And to go play a round of disc golf too." And he directed that comment at Colin and says, "Phil too, if he plays or wants to try it." And of course, Phil doesn't play and Phil doesn't really want to try it, but I'll stand and watch.
Maybe you could caddy.
Oh, you have those, do you, for disc golf?
Ah. Yeah. You know, I play very casually, but for the professionals, they'll actually have a caddy that will carry their backpack or tow their cart and sometimes handle the scoring for them and, you know, give course advice if they're not overly, if the professionals aren't overly experienced with this course.
Yeah, yeah. I never really thought of all that. I was going to ask a question, but no, we'll save that for our disc golf podcast.
Oh.
Disc golf 101. We also heard from Joe. And Joe said, this is referring back to me saying something about John Scalzi's books using he said and she said to excess. And Joe points out that Scalzi himself is aware of that issue. And he said he noticed it with Red Shirts, the book Red Shirts. And since then, he's consciously changed how he writes dialogue with that in mind. So... and Joe sent us a link to a blog post by John Scalzi where he talks about that very thing. He's becoming aware of how annoying it is to have he said, he said, he said all the way through an audiobook. So that blew my mind when I read that. So thanks, Joe, for sending that link. If you would like to join in the conversation with us, you can post comments on our blog at 101sf.blogspot.com, or you can find us on Facebook as Science Fiction 101 Podcast. Now on to our main topic for today, which is Desert Island Books. I realised I should have called this Desert Planet Books to make it more science fictional, but anyway, Desert Island Books will do us. Colin, are you familiar with the BBC Desert Island Discs, which is where this basic concept comes from?
No.
Desert Island Discs is a radio show, and it's been going since, I think, the 1940s, and it's still running. It's gone through about 6 or 7 hosts over the years. Basically, it's an interview show. They interview a celebrity, and they have to name, I think, the 6 or 8 gramophone records, pieces of music, that they would want to have with them if they were marooned on a desert island. And I think they also get to choose a book, and they get to choose a luxury item. And they also, they're always told, you will be given the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible. So everybody who lands up on this desert island automatically has Shakespeare and the Bible. So that's the original premise, and this is a BBC show that's been going for decades. So we're ripping it off and calling it Desert Island Books. What I suggested for this is that we maybe come up with one science fiction novel that we'd like to have with us if we were stuck on a desert island, one short story collection or anthology, one non-fiction book with some science fiction relevance, and one book that is completely non-science fiction. And if you like, you can also have a Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. I think, Colin, you suggested alternatives for those that were a bit more science fictional.
Yeah, if we're going to stay science fictional based, I thought we should maybe do the works of Jules Verne and a copy of Astounding by Alex Navalny Lee, or perhaps the history of science fiction, a graphic novel adventure, and a copy of every science fiction book from Gutenberg, because it would be small and it would fit on a reading device.
Of course, yes. And if we're on a desert island planet, space is very much at a premium. So, yeah. So, are you ready to go with this?
I am.
So, shall we start with one science fiction novel? If you could only have one science fiction novel with you, which one are you going to choose?
Well, I thought a lot about this. I've read a lot of science fiction over my podcasts and over my life. And I was thinking, if I was on an island, I might expect to have the very barest hope of escaping. And so I need to stay alive and be inspired. And I picked my favorite science fiction book, The Martian by Andy Weir.
So you're gonna grow potatoes.
I might grow potatoes. I might braid the hair from my back and rope 2 sea turtles and go sailing off to the next island to try and find a way off the whole thing.
Very good. Do you think you could stand to read it and reread it for year after year if you were stuck there for, you know, like 30, 40 years? Is it one of those books that would still hold your interest?
When it first came out, I read it every 6 months. And I've slowed down since then. I only read it about once a year.
That is dedication. Very good. For my novel, I thought about this and I thought, shall I take a book that I think is the best book ever written? Should I take a book that I consider to be my favourite? And in the end, I started thinking about books that were set on an island. And the first thing that came to mind, obviously, is Robinson Crusoe, which is not science fiction, although it is... it could be called proto-science fiction. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, The Island of Dr. Moreau. So I'm not saying it's the best novel of all time. It's not the best novel that H.G. Wells wrote. But it is one of his better books, and it comes from that early flurry of really great books that in which he defined the field of science fiction, whether he knew that he was doing that or not. You know, The Time Machine, The War of the Worlds, First Men in the Moon, Island of Dr. Moreau, and so on. Oh, and The Invisible Man. The Island of Dr. Moreau, I think I've only read it twice, and I do remember the first time I read it, the thing that was most striking to me was this great shift in the story that Wells was really so good at. And this is a spoiler alert. If you've never read The Island of Dr. Moreau, and you've only had, about 125 years to do it, but if you've never read it, here's the spoiler. The book, when the book begins, we're on this island and we're aware that there are people on the island and we get glimpses of them, and they seem to have animal characteristics, and it looks as if they've been operated on, and it looks for all the world as if this Dr. Moreau character has been taking people and doing vivisection operating on them and turning them into animals. But here's the big twist. It turns out to be the opposite. It turns out he's starting off with animals and he's trying to uplift them into humanity. And that twist takes it from being a horror story to being something much more to do with morality and ethics. And I think it's, even though it's dependent on that twist, I think it still works if you read it more than once. So I would like to read it more times. I've read all those other Wells novels probably half a dozen times each, but this one I think I've only read a couple of times. So that's what I'd have with me, and I'd be on the island, and I would think that I am seeing these strange creatures off in the distance.
Interesting. I thought you were going to say something or pick a Bradbury novel, but I remember that a lot of his novels are fix-ups, and so yes, they're almost short story collections.
Indeed.
And you're likely to pick a short story collection from Bradbury for your actual short story collection, so then why not branch out?
You could be right. So tell me about your short story collection or anthology.
So I don't read a lot of those, and so okay, it was kind of a challenge, and I'm on the fence between two different ones. One is a fix-up novel, iRobot by Asimov.
Yes.
Yeah, I love the logic puzzles. I love, you know, the further development and the exploration of the three laws. I like the meta narrative that happens with Dr. Calvin, and she's being interviewed by somebody for her life's work, and then out come all these robot stories, many of which involve her.
Of course.
The other one I was considering is the Star Wars collection called From a Certain Point of View. So for the 40th anniversary of Star Wars, they took a whole bunch of different science fiction authors and gave them all bit characters from the movie. And the one I can always name off the top of my head is when they're approaching the moon, where the rebel base is, there's a picture of a person standing on a watchtower watching the starships land.
Okay.
And they give that character a backstory and a little bit of plot. And so you get to touch all these people throughout the entire initial Star Wars movie and learn more about them. And you know, sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're sad, sometimes they're sweet. It's just a really nice mix. And it's all Star Wars.
What a nice idea. That actually sounds like what they've done with the whole Star Wars universe. Sort of, you've got the main story arc, but then you've got stories that focus on one character. And they're going, in my view, into more and more minor characters and beginning to populate the universe with people who perhaps aren't even in the original trilogy.
Let me pick a small nit.
Yeah.
So there was Andor, who was a big part of the Rogue One movie, which is, you know, the prequel to Star Wars, and they upload the plans that were stolen and given to Princess Leia to take to Alderaan.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Solo, which was about Han Solo, and then Obi-Wan, who was kind of a bit character in the first, really in all three movies, but the current miniseries about Ahsoka, she seems to be Dave Filoni's darling character. So she showed up in the original animated movie, which is a prequel to the book, or the second movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And then through most of the seven seasons of The Clone Wars. And then she shows up in everything else that he seems to touch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the animated series Rebels, she's a big part of that. And so really, I think he's developing his own version of the Skywalker arc just with Ahsoka.
Yeah, that's nice for him. A nice little earner, as we call it.
Yeah, I'm sure it pays the bills.
Yeah, exactly.
And which collection would you be taking?
I might be stretching the definition of collection a little bit, but I'm going to go with The Martian Chronicles by Bradbury, which is really a short story collection. He just happens to have stitched the stories together with a little bit of linking material. He called it a half cousin to a novel rather than a real novel. And it is really, as you said earlier, a kind of a fix-up of short stories. But when I went through the table of contents, there are probably maybe 8-9 stories in there that I think are near perfect. And I don't just mean near perfect examples of Bradbury, I mean near-perfect science fiction short stories. I mean, there's Rocket Summer, which is the introduction to the book. Beautiful poetic writing about the launching of rockets and how they can transform, I think it's a Chicago winter, into a summer in an instant, just the heat of the rockets. There's the story The Third Expedition, which is also known as Mars is Heaven, which is a classic science fiction horror story. There's And the Moon Be Still as Bright, which I call a science fiction western, but it's really about somebody who's a kind of archaeologist who is deeply upset that all of the Martians have become extinct because of human disease brought from Earth. Mm-hmm. And he becomes so obsessed with the remaining cultural artifacts of the Martians that he becomes a Martian. Now, we never know for sure whether he's just gone a bit strange in the head or whether he has been possessed by the ghost of a Martian. And in fact, it doesn't matter, because either one of those two possibilities could produce exactly the same results. So it doesn't really matter. But it's a beautiful story about somebody being concerned about what we have done. There's a story called Night Meeting, which is, again, every one of these, I have to say, it's a science fiction classic. It's an Earthman meeting a Martian on Mars, and they look out at exactly the same landscape, but they see two different things because they have two different viewpoints. There's a story called The Martian, where there's a child who went missing years ago, or died. I think he died rather than went missing. He suddenly comes back. But it turns out it's really a Martian shapeshifter. And this shapeshifter will take on the appearance of whoever you are thinking about when it's in your presence. Beautiful story, tragic story as well. There's one called The Long Years, about a guy who makes robot copies of his dead wife and kids just to make it possible for him to survive on Mars, more or less alone. There will come soft rains. A nuclear war wipes out all the humans, but a robotic house built to serve humans carries on doing what it's been programmed to do because it knows nothing. It knows no other. Beautiful story, very poetic. And then there's The Million Year Picnic, which is where humans basically realize that they are now the Martians. All of these perfect miniature science fiction stories. That would have to be my choice of short story collection. The alternative would have been a sort of an author collection like The Complete Stories of H.G. Wells. But I thought I'd choose something that's a little bit more manageable. So you went for The Martian. I went for The Martian Chronicles. What about a non-fiction book that has some science fiction relevance?
Oh, that one was hard.
Yeah.
I don't read a lot of nonfiction. And, you know, the two nonfiction books that I might have picked are the ones that are provided for me automatically. So, you know, Astounding by Nawal Ali and, you know, The History of Science Fiction, the graphic novel.
Yeah.
And so I kind of went back to this idea about having the opportunity to escape. And so I picked Fundamentals of Physics.
Right.
Which was my college physics book. So should I need to do research on electromagnetism or propulsion or statics and dynamics, which is how you make things that move and don't move?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it would all be there in one collected volume.
Brilliant. Do you remember the author?
It's a pair of authors, Halliday and Resnick.
Oh, okay. I don't know that one. Because I did physics at university. My first degree was in physics. And we never referred to the books by their titles. We always referred to them by the name of the author. So the lecturer would say, you should go and look in your Bizer. Okay, I'll go and look in my Bizer. I can't remember what the book was called, but it was written by somebody called Bizer. And there was one by Dickey and Witka. And again, I can't remember what the book was called. But not an engineering book then. So you don't think something that would sort of talk you through the Archimedean spiral would be useful for getting water up out of deep wells or something?
Oh. No, I hadn't thought about that. I was way more fundamental.
Yeah, going back to first principles on everything. Yeah. I also struggled with this one. I mean, I had some books that were about science fiction that I thought I might take. But then I thought, no, what I'll do is I'll have something that is from the field of science. And that makes it science fiction adjacent, if you like. So after a lot of umming and ahhing, I decided I'd go with a Stephen Jay Gould book, because he is one of the scientist authors who most influenced me when I was reading a lot of non-fiction. And I read every single one of his books as they came out. This was during the 90s, I suppose. Now, he was an evolutionary biologist, and he was also a great skeptic and kind of debunker of pseudoscience. So he wrote a lot of stuff that was very accessible to a non-expert. But he also wrote a number of books that were very detailed studies, but for a general reader. And I think the very best of them is called The Mismeasure of Man, which is about attempts to measure intelligence. And he talks through all of the things that are now considered complete pseudoscience, like phrenology, you know, reading the bumps on your head, measuring the size of somebody's skull to determine how intelligent they are, and then goes through to IQ tests, which is one of the things that we still use today, even though there's very little support for the idea that IQ tests really measure intelligence. What they measure is your ability to do IQ tests, nothing more, yes, nothing less. But it's a fantastic book, and it absolutely shows how even rational, scientifically minded people can completely delude themselves, because nearly every method we've used to try and measure intelligence has ended up favouring the social group, the race, the nationality of the person who devised the test. And the tests nearly always give poor results to people who are different to that person. So all attempts to measure intelligence end up being profoundly racist. And I think that's probably the bottom line of the book, the most powerful statement that the book is able to make. But it's a really good book, and I would love to see somebody doing science fiction that was about those topics. And I'm sure somebody has, and I'm just not familiar with it.
That's really cool.
But then going for something completely non-science fictional, I'd be very interested to know what you've come up with for that.
You know, I love science fiction, mm-hmm, but I love fantasy even more.
Ah.
And so my thought, you'd have to go Tolkien.
Yeah.
Or maybe Eddings or, yes, Zelazny. I mean, there's so many choices. Mm. But I came back, and there's an author who's not as well known as I think he should be. Or I don't go around in the right fantasy circles to understand how well he's appreciated. And his name is Tad Williams. Now, I think I've mentioned Tad Williams' books to you in the past, because he has written that epic science fiction series, The Otherland Chronicles.
Yes.
He first became well known for writing a book about cats called Tail Chaser's Song. His second, and his, what I think is his best work, is Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn. And the first book in that is The Dragonbone Chair.
Okay.
And that is the book I would take. Yeah, it's classic fantasy. We're introduced to Simon, who is a young castle boy who has to work in the kitchens. He's an orphan. He has been adopted by the kitchen staff, and he's mentored by the great Dr. Morganiz, mm-hmm, who is the castle magician and scientist, for lack of a better term. But the king is elderly, and he's going to die, and he is replaced by the king's not wicked, but extremely selfish and self-serving son. Huh. And this young man has fallen in with a bad advisor who is looking for power, either power for himself or power he can control by giving it to the new king. That's the beginning of the story.
Sounds intriguing. It sounds a bit like a Cinderella story.
Have you seen the animated version of The Sword in the Stone by Disney?
Yeah.
It's the story of young Wart becoming King Arthur. It's massive, it's epic, it's multi-threaded. It's magical in a way without becoming some magical stories, you know, magic is the cure to everything. And in some stories, magic is just one of a set of tools that you can use to fix the problems that you have.
Right. Yeah.
And I tend to like the latter versus the former.
Yes, yes. And did you say that this is part of a series?
It is. It was part of a 3-book epic. And it was kind of a problem because the more Tad wrote, the better he liked it, which means he wrote more. And it ended up being so large that the softback, paperback versions had to be broken into 2 sets. And so some people call it a 4-volume epic, but if you get the original hardbacks, there's only 3.
Presumably this is, if you attempted to make a single volume of this, it would be too thick to even stay together as a hardcover, presumably.
Oh, yeah, it would be, you know, several thousand pages.
Whoa. That sounds like that will keep you very busy on the island, even if you just have the single first volume.
Yeah, I remember when the final book of the series came out. So it was while I was in college, as an undergrad even. And when it came out, I read the final book in 3 days. Just marathon book reading. It was spring. I was all done with band, and so there were no sporting events to go cover. And school, you know, there was work that you had to do, but I didn't have to study very hard. I learned extremely quickly. So I had lots of spare time, and that's what I did for, you know, a weekend and a day.
Wow. What is great is when you come across a book that is so engrossing that you literally can't put it down. And there have, for me, there have been very few of those. I do remember the first couple of H.G. Wells books that I ever read. Those, for me, were unputdownable. But that's been extremely rare in my life to find anything that is so unputdownable. And the only other author who I've found that to be the case more than once was, strangely, Michael Crichton, because his books are such page-turners.
Yeah, they're very well paced. They're usually near-term science fiction, and so I felt like I could identify with them and understand the characters and what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. So that was your non-science fiction book, and you promised me that it is all magic in there, is it? There's no science motivating any of the action.
There is one scientific element. The evil magician has altered the tower that his laboratory is in so that he can tell the time by the view outside the window. The entire tower rotates.
Oh, okay.
And there's a massive geared structure underneath the castle below the dungeons that is served by the evil Dr. Inch, who is his henchman.
Fantastic. What a great length to go to just to tell the time. Couldn't he just make it?
Yeah, there may have been other reasons for it. I just, because he's all about the study of the stars, and there's a comet involved.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of astronomy that's there too.
Yeah. Very good. You're making it sound interesting now, you see, by admitting to there being some science fiction content.
Yeah. Well, let me see if I can finally set the hook. So most fantasy stories have the quest, which you have to do to free the princess, get the cure, do whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
What if you did the quest and found out it was completely wrong?
Aha. Uh-huh. Is that what happens?
It might.
Aha. Uh-huh. I might read a plot summary of this book. No, you do make it sound very interesting. Very good. Shall I tell you about my totally non-science fiction book?
Please, yeah.
I thought I would go non-fiction again, because that was one of the easiest ways of keeping away from science fiction was to not go anywhere near fiction. So I started thinking again about non-fiction books, and the one that I settled on is a book by Mark Lewison, and it's called Tune In, and it's his first volume of biography of the Beatles.
Oh.
And it came out about 10 years ago. And he's still working on Volume 2 and Volume 3, which are promised sort of any day now. But it's been 10 years since the first volume came out. What Lewison does is he does quite a bit of myth-busting about the Beatles. And he's always very concerned to get documentary evidence of everything that he says in reconstructing their life history. And he goes into incredible detail about where they were at particular times, the music they were listening to, the books they were reading, and that kind of thing. Now, I am a Beatle fan, so you might think that this is just a Beatle fan liking a Beatle book. But actually, I've got very few books about the Beatles, because with one or two exceptions of reference works, I don't find them very interesting. But what Lewison does is he goes into immense detail on the lives of these, well, I was going to say these four individuals, you know, the Beatles, but it's actually about five or six individuals, because you've got people who were in the Beatles but then were not in the Beatles, kind of thing. But he also talks about the music they were influenced by. And a friend of mine suggested that the best way to read the book is to have Spotify open. And whenever Lewison refers to a song that the Beatles were listening to at a particular time, they were in Hamburg and they heard a Fats Domino record, call it up on Spotify and listen to it while you read. And all of a sudden, the book, which is enormously long in the first place, expands in front of you, because you've got this wealth of music and musical styles. And now, on the desert island, I'm not going to have Spotify, I don't think, because I doubt that there will be cell phone service or Wi-Fi. But having listened to some of those bits of music while reading the book, if I read the book again, I think it will bring those bits of music back into mind. So I think this would be a very immersive form of non-fiction reading. Anyone who is a Beatles fan and wants to read about the Beatles, this is the book to read. Tune in. This book, though, only goes up to the point where the Beatles sign their record contract. They only just become the Beatles by the end of this book. And then he's got two more books to come, which is going to tell their sort of peak career story, if you like. But it's incredibly good. The depth of historical research and the integrity of the research is really what impresses me. Although I'm not a historian, I am very interested in archival research, and I've done quite a bit of archival work myself. And seeing other people do it with such meticulousness and attention to detail always impresses me. So that's my book, and it has literally nothing to do with science fiction.
Well, one can't science fiction all the time.
No, one cannot.
Yeah, the idea that the book has a soundtrack reminds me of a scratch and sniff book.
Yes,
because it's immersive and inclusive and engaging.
Yeah, and I don't know if there has ever been an audiobook version of this, but it strikes me that it cries out to be turned into an audiobook with those bits of music playing in the background whenever they're mentioned, you know.
Yeah, can you imagine the licensing nightmare of that?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Wow. Although if you wait long enough, then...
Till the copyright runs out.
Yeah, unless it's extended again, but who knows?
Yeah. I think that's it, isn't it? I think we've covered all of our main picks.
Yeah.
Have you got any also-rans, things that you would have liked to have included but didn't quite have room for in the suitcase that you're taking with you to the desert island?
The Silo series was being adapted by Apple TV, and so I was able to purchase the omnibus edition of Silo. It's every Silo novel and every Silo short story all in one big, you know, a collection.
Yeah.
And I tried to find such a thing for Timothy Zahn's Heir to the Empire series.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist.
Ah, I thought about all sorts of books, and even as I'm sitting here now, I'm looking around the shelves, and I haven't got very much science fiction in this particular room that I'm in, but I have got all of my Bradbury books in a cupboard to my left here, and all of my Ellison books over the other side of the room. And just looking around, I can see things that I think, oh, I'd love to have all of this. And of course, the solution would be to smuggle a Kindle in your suitcase.
Yeah, well, a Kindle and a solar cell.
Well, yes, of course. Or, I don't know, a little wind-up generator would do the job.
Yeah, or a copy of Halliday and Resnick, which would tell you the physics needed to build a generator
from first principles.
There you go. Or maybe one of the novelizations of a Gilligan's Island episode. So you could learn how the professor would take some coconut halves and braided palm strings, palm fronds, to make a generator.
Perfect. Tell me about the quiz.
Well, this is from Andy, like you mentioned, and Andy had particularly designed this for our second Doctor Who episode, and we didn't get to it in time. Mm-hmm. So we're one episode late, but we're going to do it anyway. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, there are 10 questions, so this will be easy to score at the end.
Okay.
The question one, according to the famous Dr. Seuss book and movie, what does Horton hear?
A who.
A who, that is correct.
Brilliant.
Question two, which English rock band is fronted by Roger Daltrey?
That will be The Who.
Yes. Perfect. Question three. What is defined as the attribute of a color by virtue of which it is discernible as red or green, etc., and which is dependent on its dominant wavelength and independent of intensity or lightness?
That will be its hue.
Yes.
I'm getting a pattern now.
You're getting a pattern? Is it coming through?
I think I do know the answer to every single one of these questions, and it's just going to be a matter of pronunciation, isn't it?
Question four. What is the sixth largest city in Vietnam, famously twinned with Honolulu in Hawaii and New Haven, Connecticut?
Well, I've never heard of such a place, but I'm guessing it is Who.
It is definitely Who based.
Ah.
If I'm reading this correctly, I think it's Hue.
Okay.
So we'll give you half credit for that, because you have one of the two phonemes.
Okay.
What is the first name of the actor who famously played Wolverine in the Marvel franchise of films?
The first name?
Oh, the first name of that man.
Yeah, Hugh.
Hugh.
Jackman.
Yes. If I asked you who played Professor Harold Hill in the recent Broadway revival of The Music Man, and that would be...
Give me that one again.
If I were to ask you, because this is not on the quiz.
Okay.
If I were to ask you who played Professor Harold Hill in the recent Broadway revival of The Music Man...
Well, I would say you are correct. Who did play that person? This is the Abbott and Costello quiz now.
Yes.
Who's on first?
Yep. Okay, moving on. We've done five questions. You're 4.5 out of 5.
Okay.
You're rock solid. Question six. Fill in the missing word from this famous British tea slogan.
Okay.
You only get a blank with Typhoo.
Well, it must be a who, surely. It's an ooh.
It's an ooh. Good correction. Which Mongolian folk metal band played Glastonbury 2023 and also mentioned the Sri Lankan science fiction novel, The Salvage Crew?
Oh, I have no idea. So I'm just going to do what I have been doing for the past six questions. I'm just going to say who.
Who is correct. The band is H-U, Who.
Oh my God.
What is the French translation for where, as in where are you?
Ooh.
Perfect. See, it's a good thing you're taking this quiz because I don't speak French.
Okay.
And in Spanish and German, that would be vo and donde. So.
Okay. Yes. How would you have done with the Typhoo tea question?
I would not have gotten that one either.
No.
I do drink some tea, but I don't drink British tea because I'm in the United States. Okay, this one's going to be hard. Which master is played by Jackie Chan in the Lego Ninjago movie?
Well, again, I have no idea, so I'm just going to have to say who.
This one is Wu.
Oh.
Close to a who. Mm-hmm. Okay. Fill in the missing word. To blank it may concern. I really enjoyed this quiz and podcast as a whole.
And the answer is whom?
Whom? Not bad. 8.5 out of 10.
I'm amazed. And I really thought there would be an Abbott and Costello question in there.
Oh, who's on first? But
yeah, I thought we were going to get there.
Yeah, this reminds me of the quiz that Seth gave us, the Ray, Brad, and Barry quiz.
Oh, yeah, let's not go there. Well, thank you, Andy Parry, for being fiendish, but actually that's quite a generous quiz, I thought.
Oh, yeah, pretty clever to work in who.
Okay, shall we move on to past, present, and future?
Yes.
So, I bring a strange past item here. This is something that I had never, ever heard of before. It's a TV series from 1960 and 1961, from before I was born. So, yeah, there's no reason why I should have seen this series. I doubt if it was ever repeated. But it came out on DVD a few years ago, and I only just picked it up recently. It's called Pathfinders. Actually, there were three seasons. Pathfinders in Space, Pathfinders to Mars, and Pathfinders to Venus. And these were made by ITV, which is the commercial TV channel. At the time, in 1960, the UK only had two TV channels, BBC and ITV. And this was on ITV. And it was a science fiction series about a rocket scientist and his kids. And they kind of go off to various places. And the very first series of it is missing because it wasn't recorded. But the remaining series survive. And it's a strange mixture of terrible and somewhat interesting. What's interesting about it is that it's written by two people who, a couple of years later, would write for Doctor Who. It's produced by Sidney Newman, who... This was his last production for ITV before he went off to the BBC and created Doctor Who. And although this isn't like Doctor Who, it's not a time travel series or anything like that. It doesn't have any fantasy elements. It tries to be science fictional. It clearly is in the same genre as Doctor Who in being aimed mainly at children. But apparently this show had, of all the shows... All the TV shows that were on Christmas Day in 1961, this had the second highest viewing figures. The highest viewing figures were for the Queen's Speech, which is an annual event. And the second highest viewing figures were for this thing called Pathfinders in Space, or to Mars, or to Venus. The visual effects are terrible. They have some pre-filmed shots of model rockets, which are okay. You can see the strings sometimes, but it's okay. They make some nice miniatures of the lunar surface, but then they cut to the actual lunar surface that the actors are walking around on. And it's clearly made out of plywood because you can hear their feet plunking on the floor. Oh. They wear space helmets that have no glass in them because in early rehearsals they realised they couldn't pick up the sound of the actors' voices through the glass. So they took the glass out of the helmet. And in place of the glass, they put two pieces of wire, one running from top to bottom and one running from left to right, to signify where the glass would have been if the glass was still there. So it looks really bizarre. It just looks really, really cheap. But it is full of little scientific nuggets, little facts. It's as if they've written this fantasy adventure in space and then they've gone through it and sprinkled in a few little scientific facts about this is how gravity works, this is the rocket equation. And so it's a very strange thing. I can't exactly recommend it to people because it's not good enough to recommend. But if you're interested in the history of British television science fiction, I think you've got to look at Pathfinders because it ran for four seasons and was one of the most watched shows of its age. And it immediately precedes Doctor Who. So it's got to be significant in some way. So there you go. What a strange thing.
Well, and how interesting that it was the most popular ITV series or event aside from the Queen's Speech.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't want to take us down a rabbit trail, but maybe this is an idea for another episode, because off the top of my head, I could name 8 or 12 books which I would tell a young person who is interested in reading fantasy what to read.
Yeah.
Appropriate for age level, appropriate for content. I can't do that with science fiction. I could do that for an adult.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the kids' level of things.
Yeah, I couldn't, because I haven't read any science fiction that's aimed at kids. And the few bits that I have read are really old. So, you know, they're juveniles written by Heinlein and Asimov, and they just don't stand up because of the age of them, you know.
I actually enjoy reading books written for younger people because they have a simplicity to them that I really like.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, okay. I have a quick past item to mention in passing, and then I'm going to come back and re-tag it for the future.
Okay.
I, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, was a comic book collector.
Right.
And I collected just a handful of topics that were very personally interesting just to me. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'll say about that now.
Okay. How very mysterious. So, shall we move on to present items?
Yes.
Okay, I've got one present item. I put this in present because it's sort of happening around about now. I think it's spread out over a few days or maybe a couple of weeks. And it's an auction. There's an auction of objects that belonged to Greg Jean, who was a great science fiction special effects person. He made miniatures for films and TV, and he was also a collector. And he died maybe a year or two ago, and all of his stuff is being auctioned. My item is not the auction, it's the auction catalogue, because the auction company, which is called Heritage Auctions, puts together these most incredible catalogues of the things that they sell, and they've done a beautiful catalogue for the Greg Jean collection, and it's got stuff in it from Star Trek, Lost in Space, Forbidden Planet, all the things that Greg Jean worked on as well, which are things that are a bit more recent, which I think include Battlestar Galactica, and right through to modern Star Trek productions and things like that. But it's an incredible catalogue of a collection. Even if you have no interest in buying anything, and most of the items in the catalogue are thousands of dollars as the starting price. For example, you can buy a William Shatner hairpiece that he wore when playing Captain Kirk in the original series, and a pair of Spock ears. And these are listed as being a starting price of maybe $1,000 or something. But the catalogue is a beautiful history of science fiction film and television. And there's a PDF available of it. I'll put a link on our website so that anybody can go and have a look. I don't know if it'll stay there forever. In other words, after the auction, they'll probably take it down. So use the link, download the catalogue, and browse it at your leisure. It is a thing of beauty.
I have one present item, and that is John Scalzi, who is, you know, one of my favorite science fiction current authors. His newest book, Starter Villain, was just released this week.
Right. Does he use he said and she said in the book?
I haven't read it yet.
Okay.
I'm kind of bummed. Mm-hmm. I think this one, I'm going to borrow it from the library. And so there's the waiting queue for that book is, you know, hundreds of people deep.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Any more present items?
No, but I have several for what I'm calling the near future.
Okay. Go ahead. Give us one.
On October 21st, the Hugo Awards are going to be announced.
Yep.
And I'm hoping that our friend Seth is mentioned high on that list.
For Hugo's There?
For Hugo's There. Yeah. Best fan podcast, I think the category is called.
Yeah.
And it will be, I think it's going to be live streamed, so I'll be watching along and hopefully everything goes well.
Terrific. It is well deserving. It's a very well conceived podcast, and it's one of those where when I first knew about it and first saw the concept, I thought, I wish I'd thought of that. You know, and then basically it's taking everything that's won the Hugo Award and reviewing it. And it's such a simple concept, really easily explained, and yet he's done it so so very thoroughly by having a series of guests, including me.
And me. Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing is he's really engaged with his fan base in bringing them on. And then when he can, brings in other people with an interest to this particular book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the inception of Hugo's There 2.0, because unfortunately for Seth, he's done all the Hugo winners aside from this year's.
Yeah, yeah.
And going forward, he's just going to keep reviewing books in this format, whether it's books that have won like the Locus or the Nebula or another award,
yeah,
or his favorite books or books that are suggested to him. But he's just going to continue that format going forward.
Yeah. I've got one future item, and that is a Netflix series promised for next year, 2024, which is called Three Body Problem. And that's the number three body problem, which is based on a well-known novel you may have heard of called The Three Body Problem, where is three spelled out as a word. So they've very ingeniously modified the title for no particular reason. It's promised for January 2024 currently, but I mean, it's a very well-known book which had critical acclaim and won some awards when it came out. It's a book I struggled with. I think I only read the first couple of chapters and decided I wasn't really enjoying it very much, but I would very much like to see a decent adaptation of it, so I'm hoping that's what this is going to be. The only thing that makes me a little bit anxious is that they started shooting for this in 2021, so it's taken 2.5 to 3 years to get it on air, and doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. It may just be that there's a lot of special effects work and all of that, and COVID delays, and you know. But often when you hear something that's been delayed and delayed and delayed, there's a reason, and the reason is because there is some quality control issue in the story department. But hey, we'll wait and see. But I'm looking forward to seeing that.
It's an interesting introduction to Chinese culture through science fiction.
Yeah.
And because of the things going on currently in China, that's going to be controversial.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah. Maybe you should think about picking up the book and trying to finish it so that you can compare to see how well, you know, it adapts.
Yeah, although I was hoping that one of my favorite podcasts, Take Me to Your Reader, might do that for me.
It is possible. We have shied away from anthology series. We've done a couple, but not very much. And we have not done any mini series.
Okay.
But we're going to break that, I think, in December. Ooh. So we'll see.
Okay. I look forward to that.
I have one other near future event, which is for October.
Okay.
Here in the United States, we have a company called Fathom Events. And what this company does is takes non-movie or old movie events and replays them in theaters. Mm-hmm. So if you want to see the Metropolitan Opera, or if you want to see the International Drum Corps competition, or if you want to see movies which are 40 years old this year, you can go to the theater and have a theater experience for it. In October, there are three science fiction movies of note: Back to the Future, The Hunger Games, and The Birds.
Very good stuff, all of it.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, there was something that you said earlier as a past item, and then you said you were going to tag it as future or something?
What? I did, and I completely didn't write it in my notes. I read a lot in order to stay up to date with science fiction news and to talk about things on podcasts and to look for future adaptations that are coming.
Yeah.
There is a future adaptation of a Doctor Who comic, which I collected in the late 80s or early 90s. I don't know the exact date of it off the top of my head. Yeah. I showed you a picture of that comic book when we recorded it. Yeah. And it's mentioned in passing, where they're talking about a Doctor Who production that's going to come out as a special this year. And they were casting for a character who is in the Star Beast comic from Doctor Who.
Is this being made as part of the main Doctor Who series, or is this something else?
No, it'll be a regular episode, one of the specials. I think they called it 803.
Very
good. So season 8, special episode 3 or something.
Okay. Intriguing. Any more items?
Nope.
Are we done then?
I think we're done.
That seemed to go very quickly today. Thanks for listening, folks. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. Check out our show notes at 101sf.blogspot.com, where you can also leave us a comment, or you can drop a couple of quatloos in our tip jar. Thought I'd try a different currency for a change. And don't forget to give us a nice 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time.